Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, guest host Doug Becker explores the most sweeping attempt to ban nuclear weapons, the motivations behind it, its importance on nuclear states' decisions, and its prospect for adoption. But first, how is international law changing for human rights and for war, says our next guest, moving from protecting state security to increasingly protecting individual security. These shifts are influenced by the human rights frame and reshaping the scope of what she calls humanity's law. Ruti Tytel joins us now. She is professor of law at New York University and author of Transitional Justice and her latest, Humanity's Law. Welcome, Ruti Tytel. Let's start with the fundamental concepts of your book, Humanity's Law, the idea that international law, the laws of war, the laws of peace, human rights law, is evolving. Give us a little bit of historic background of how we've come to where we are today, starting with, say, the Geneva Conventions, the UN Charter.
My book tells the story of how there is now a framework that connects up the law of war, international human rights law, and the new enforcement through international criminal justice. And I argue that this has come about in order to really fill in the gaps given the rise of different kind of conflict today and globalization. Just tracing this history, you could say part of it started at the end of World War II with the rise of human rights law, but you also have a long-standing kind of evolution in the law of war. And you mentioned the Geneva Conventions. These have evolved over time, obviously based on older conventions, the Hague Convention and so on. We're really seeing a revival of a much older set of norms that go back to the just war tradition, and that what we had in the modern state, the kind of conventions and the regulation that people were concerned with for the last 200 years really hasn't been enough, because it really is premised on state sovereigns controlling their own citizens, and that what we are seeing today is a revival of a much older tradition that goes back to Hugo Grotius and the view that there are certain interventions that are just. And that's really a major shift in both law and in conflict today.
We've got a lot of different developments that deal with non-state actors, and as you mentioned, a different kind of conflict. Talk about what some of these things are that you see as contributing to the need to change the approach.
There are new threats. You could say there's certainly the old one, interstate conflict, but today we also see that most conflict is internal, including civil war, genocide, and other large-scale atrocities. If you add transnational organized crime, terrorism, and then also nuclear, radiological, chemical, and biological weapons, and then lastly, economic and social threats, poverty, infectious diseases, environmental degradation. What this means is that most of the threats and vulnerabilities today are internal to states. And you're talking about a world that is highly connected and interdependent without world government, without political integration. So that spells out really the kind of gaps we see today that result in the possibility of large numbers of casualties due to civil wars and other kinds of conflict that we've seen in recent years. If you think about the breakup of the former Yugoslavia or the genocide in Rwanda.
You said it's hard to say when we're at war or when we're at peace. And these kinds of confusing situations, because of these changes in interstate, intrastate relations and conflicts, have been something new that we're dealing with. And so you're seeing kind of this overlap in the laws even of war and laws of peace. How were they distinguished and how are they emerging today?
In the past, the law of war was generally associated with constraints on the waging of war, and particularly international conflict. The Geneva Conventions have evolved since the end of World War II to include some internal conflict and really to try to address issues of decolonization and self-determination. But for the most part, the law of war addressed interstate conflict. That was really the traditional view, is that it's really about protecting state borders borders and the sovereignty of states. So today, the shift is that we need more and more to fill in this gap of conflict that is internal and ethnic, this kind of ethnic persecution that now goes by the name ethnic cleansing. And so judges and other lawmakers have articulated this problem of this gap in legal protection. That's one set of developments. And then coming from the other side, from international human rights law, that was a set of norms that was associated with peacetime and really always thought of as claims that are made vis-a-vis the state. But today we see that there are a variety of scenarios where, as you pointed out, conflict is murky. If you think about the former Soviet Union, the Islamic frontier in the Soviet Union, there have been rulings in the European Court of Human Rights that apply both human rights law and the law of conflict out of a concern to protect life as much as possible in those conflicts. And there are other scenarios we've seen, for example, in the former Yugoslavia, where some of the conflict was internal and some of it was international. And the courts are saying that from a citizen's perspective, what difference does it make? Can't be that protection will only apply if the conflict is fully international. And I would add one other piece, and that is the enforcement strand, which now is really depending more and more on international criminal law and tribunals. And that's because this has all become individualized. And that's another way that we see the move away from the state and the protection of state sovereignty.
You also mentioned that these non-state actors, like the militias, are also being held responsible. In fact, you talk about rights and then you talk about responsibilities all becoming kind of individualized. Give us an example of these legal responsibilities that are being expanded.
So some of the examples where really this has been, you know, subject of rulings in the Balkans, a number of the actors that really were responsible for the most heinous atrocities were paramilitary actors. They weren't political leaders. And in fact, the first case before the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is the case of Duško Tadić, who is found on the run in Germany. And he was paramilitary, but was responsible for terrible crimes against humanity in the Omarska detention camp. They called it a concentration camp. And so that's one example where he's held to account in this tribunal, where it really the kinds of crimes that he's convicted of were crimes that were thought to be crimes associated really with state leaders. There are other examples where state actors are held responsible even for omission to protect, including some level of responsibility for non-state actors. And we've seen that, for example, in Latin America, in part of the quote-unquote terror war, where Fujimori and some of his, if you will, paramilitary actors were, you know, where the state was held responsible for some of those actions in the quote-unquote war against terror in Peru, so counter-terror measures. So those are two aspects where you have an expansion of enforcement. On the one hand, the individual enforcement against a non-state actor, but on the other, states are also more responsible now. They too have to develop capacities and are being held responsible for actions taken by non-state actors.
You also note that this new shape of humanities law has become justification for intervention, which can sometimes also be harmful.
That's true. And my books, it's really seeking to explain the kinds of war we're seeing, the kinds of global engagements we've been seeing over the last 10, 15 years leading up, and I think it's a great example of the intervention in Libya. In the past, again, when people talked about the law of war, they were largely talking about constraints on the waging of war. My framework goes back to an earlier pre-modern international law and observes that what we're seeing today is the invocation of norms of preservation, going back to Hobbes and other thinkers, and that preservation is the most important, and that this is being used as a justification, and that it really is a justification for military intervention today. So I would say Libya, the actions taken at the Security Council to intervene in what was an internal conflict in Libya, are a really good illustration of the way this kind of framework is affecting political actors today.
Perhaps if we look back a little bit further, we also see the bombing of Kosovo.
That's right. The bombing of Kosovo, I would say, predates some of the most recent legal developments, was known as an example where many saw it as a justified intervention, given the atrocities and the failure of the state to be able to protect certainly some of its ethnic peoples. But it was known as illegal but legitimate. I would say today, given what we saw in the Security Council, the intervention in Libya, no one's saying it's illegal. People might differ on the legitimacy question, but you had a rare authorization at the Security Council that was justified explicitly in terms of the protection of civilians. And we really haven't seen that ever before.
So if we were going to look at the developments that are coming now, we have major global changes, and it seems like it will potentially further this idea of individualization of international law. We've got mass migration, climate change, but globalization economically. How would you say humanity's law is becoming intertwined with these developments?
Clearly, we can see that it's case by case, and that the claim for protection may well exceed, the normativity may well exceed the current possibility of delivery. It's kind of like a substance process divide right now. And it needs to be case by case, because there are instances where there may well be an important claim for protection, but it may well not be feasible. If it only can be done with aerial bombing, as we saw the example of Afghanistan, this could result in too many lives being lost. Certainly, the argument clearly seemed off in Iraq. Now, when you're talking about globalization, obviously, there are a number of different threats that affect persons and peoples, so we could discuss that. I don't know if you're talking about economic security primarily or economic threats as the next, what humanity's law would have to say about that.
Across the globe, seeing these matters that affect all people in an interconnected way, whether it is the mass migration, which is really blurring borders considerably, and when we look at climate change, how it affects so many people of so many different states, and then the economic sort of intertwining that has gone on with globalization. Immigration could be seen as a globalization issue as well. And there are a lot of human rights issues that are tied up in that also.
And I would say that certainly with respect to the economic question, there are going to be issues of how much can be addressed by outside states and by the international community. But I think right now what we're seeing is the articulation of the values of the normativity and a clear recognition that the problems today, the gaps, they don't know the limit of state borders. They're not defined by state borders, these threats. And so the old interstate security framework, as reflected by the UN and the Security Council, if it just follows the post-World War II framework, it just can't really deal with the problems today. Now, can one protect civilians all over the globe from all of these potential threats? This is really an important question today, and clearly one that is being raised in many forms. What we're seeing today, for example, in Europe, the kind of economic issues, the massive unemployment, the challenges to the social welfare state that they'd had, obviously they were better off than many in many parts of the globe, but it's an interesting illustration of the kind of regional help that the way society and European society is being redefined over this threat, and leading some to say that perhaps it takes threats to redefine the parameters of international society.
This idea of undermining state sovereignty in favor of protecting the individual, it seems like that started to occur a while back, even with the, say, establishment of the European Court of Human Rights, and that institution trying to surpass the idea of the state. Would you say that it goes back that far?
Certainly there were trends, but what I'm identifying is not necessarily the diminishment of state sovereignty, but rather the relativization of it. In many of these instances, as we've been discussing, it's calling for intervention, calling for greater capacity on the part of states in order to be able to protect civilians on a transnational basis and to rise to the challenge of some of these threats. In some instances, the state itself has this greater duty to protect, you know, has been now recognized since 2000. 2005 at the UN with this language of the quote-unquote responsibility to protect. It's a duty to intervene. So this is very different than the kind of human rights raised just internally vis-a-vis the state. This is just a different order, a different paradigm. And so in the first instance, it's the state's duty to do that. And then the next question is, well, what happens when states fail to do so? And we saw that that duty to protect was really the basis for a coalition to intervene in Libya. It's not just a limiting of states, but rather has become a new basis for global engagement.
Well, that's a perfect place to end. Ruti Tytel is with us. Her book is called Humanity's Law. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, guest host Doug Becker explores the most sweeping attempt to ban nuclear weapons, the motivations behind it, its importance on nuclear states' decisions, and its prospect for adoption. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In 2017, the United Nations General Assembly passed a mandate to negotiate a treaty that would ban nuclear weapons. While it passed 122-1, no nuclear state or NATO member other than the Netherlands voted on the resolution. 70 nations have signed the treaty and 23 have ratified it. When it reaches 50 ratifying parties, it will be in force. But many doubt its effectiveness without the support of any of the 9 nuclear states. Today, our guest host, Doug Becker, discusses this treaty with 2 experts. Ira Helfand joins us. He is co-chair of the Physicians for Social Responsibility's Nuclear Abolition Committee and serves on the International Coalition Against Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN's Steering Committee. He is co-author of Nuclear Family, 2 Billion at Risk. We're also joined by Professor Wayne Glass. He's an emeritus professor in the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California, and also the former senior policy advisor to Senator Jeff Bingaman on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Let's start, Ira Helfand, with a brief description of what is the status of the treaty, what is the treaty trying to accomplish, and how does it differ from some current arms control treaties, most notably the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty?
I think that the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons is in fact an extension of the Nonproliferation Treaty. Under the Nonproliferation Treaty, the nuclear weapon states which signed that treaty agreed to negotiate in good faith to eliminate the nuclear arsenals. But 50 years have passed and they haven't done that. And the non-nuclear armed states have been searching for ways to put pressure on the nuclear armed states to honor their obligations under that existing treaty. The nuclear armed states expect the non-nuclear states to honor their end of the treaty and not develop nuclear weapons, but they have showed no intention at all to honor their obligations under the treaty. And so the international community came together in a very extraordinary fashion and said, we are not going to put up with this anymore. We have got to do something to try to put pressure on the nuclear armed states to, in fact, negotiate the abolition of their arsenals as they promised to do. So I think that's the real significance of this treaty. For many years now, the non-nuclear weapon states have been frozen out. They've just been ignored. And they felt that by coming together in this new treaty, they could put pressure on the nuclear armed states. And the reaction of the nuclear armed states, I think, has clearly vindicated this approach. The nuclear armed states are very opposed to this treaty. They've worked very hard to derail it, and they have not.
But my understanding of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was that was at least meant to eventually move towards at least significant reductions in nuclear weapons by trying to limit, if not completely, you know, control the development of the new classes of nuclear weapons, the so-called modernization debates. Wayne Glass, what kind of effect has the CTBT, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, had on states like the United States in trying to modernize their nuclear arsenals?
As you know, Doug, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was defeated by vote in the Senate. I believe it was in 1998. And so the treaty remains not in force. It has not met all the requirements to become a treaty in force. And so in defeating that treaty in the U.S. Senate, it's pretty clear that the United States wanted to guard its own options with respect to sustaining and modernizing its own nuclear weapons inventory. But that's still the case. You know, it's almost an annual battle in the Congress about funding new types of nuclear weapons, which are in fact modifications of existing nuclear weapons. So U.S. efforts towards modernizing the nuclear arsenal remain in effect unabated, despite the existence of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty that's signed by I don't know how many countries, but and ratified by I don't know how many countries, but not yet in force, because it hasn't met the minimum requirements to enter into force. Does that answer the question, Doug?
Yes, yes. Although I do want to confirm, since this Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty has been signed, have any country that actually signed and ratified it tested the nuclear weapon?
Oh, not to my knowledge. There's some game playing with respect to what constitutes a nuclear test. And so countries' nuclear weapons states have been testing things in a subcritical mode, which according to a technical definition doesn't actually constitute a nuclear detonation. So there's some semantical games that are being played by the nuclear weapons state at this point, including the United States. So the stultifying effect of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was the intent, certainly hasn't prevented the United States from moving forward with modernizing and changing their weapons. The U.S., of course, would claim that, oh, we're just making them safer and more reliable. But in fact, I think some of the testing and the program developments are to in effect, create a weapon that can perform a different mission. So there's this an argument over whether that constitutes a new nuclear weapon or whether a modification of an old nuclear weapon. Nonetheless, I think through the eyes of the rest of the world, looking at the U.S. arsenal, much of the world realizes that the United States is not being impeded from moving forward with their various nuclear weapons programs.
Ira Helfand, what seems to be the foundation behind this conversation, behind the motivation for this treaty, is a particularly unique and you know, perhaps, you know, even more devastating effect of nuclear weapons than other forms of weapons. I know in 1925, when the states in the international community were negotiating the prohibition on the use of chemical weapons, one question that was raised, particularly in the Senate debate, was, does it matter if you're killed by a chemical weapon or by a conventional weapon? So what makes nuclear weapons any different than, say, you know, conventional weapons, you know, bombs, missiles, assault rifles, in that, you know, wartime leads to deaths?
Well, I think the thing that makes nuclear weapons different is that they alone, among all weapons, have the ability to destroy civilization as we know it. For an individual, it really doesn't matter if you're blown up or if you're shot. But we can't destroy human civilization with rifles or bayonets or even chemical weapons. With nuclear weapons, we can destroy human civilization, and we've come very close to doing it on many occasions. And what we've learned in the last decade is that even a very limited use of nuclear weapons would create enough climate disruption worldwide to end civilization as we know it. A war that did not even necessarily involve the United States or Russia, a war perhaps that took place between India and Pakistan, and that involved a tiny fraction of the world's nuclear arsenals. So this is something totally unique about nuclear weapons, this ability not just to kill large numbers of people, but to kill such enormous numbers of people that we actually destroy our civilization.
Of course, that's the big picture, if I may add to that response, and the most compelling picture of all. But unlike conventional kinds of weapons, the nuclear weapons also have long-term effects. The radiation, the various types of radiation that come from a nuclear explosion can cause, of course, instant death, but they can cause long-term death in successive generations of humans that are affected by the radiation from a nuclear blast. So, yes, it could certainly, unfortunately, if it happens, could destroy civilization. But another way to think about the devastation of nuclear weapons is that it can have long-term health effects on human beings, not to mention the environment. We're still cleaning up Chernobyl. You can call that a nuclear explosion if you want, but the long-term radiation effects of Chernobyl are quite clear and scientifically proven. So that's an additional danger, I think, that nuclear weapons have that other weapons don't have.
So is this treaty more of an aspirational statement in that the goal of nuclear arms negotiations should eventually move towards a zero option? Or do you see short-term or medium-term, you know, practical effects of this treaty, particularly with the opposition from the nuclear states? Ira Helfand.
I think our aspiration needs to be the elimination of nuclear weapons, and it needs to be done soon, not eventually. The treaty could provide a framework for the nuclear armed states to negotiate the reduction and elimination of their arsenals, or they could do it in a parallel form. That really isn't important. What's important is that the nine nuclear armed states sit down with each other and negotiate a verifiable, enforceable, time-bound agreement for dismantling the rest of the nuclear arsenals which they possess. And the role that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons can primarily play is to put pressure on these countries to do just that. But there's also a tremendous responsibility for those of us who live in nuclear armed states, and particularly those of us who live here in the United States, to create pressure from within our country, for our country to accede to the idea that nuclear weapons need to be abolished, to embrace this treaty, and to, in fact, lead these negotiations with the other eight nuclear armed states. This is not going to be easy, but we should not look on this as some, you know, aspirational goal for decades hence. This is something which we need to do with great urgency. We've come incredibly close to nuclear war on many occasions already during the nuclear armed era. And the danger is not getting less, it is growing. People like William Perry, the editors of The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, all believe now that we are closer to nuclear war than we have ever been. We are essentially living on borrowed time. And we need to understand that and act with the urgency that this situation demands.
While possession of nuclear weapons certainly carry a tremendous risk, Wayne, you and I both know that within international relations theory, there's been quite a bit of conversation suggesting that nuclear weapons actually serve as peacemakers, or peacekeepers at least. In particular, you know, thinking of the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. How much confidence do you have that nuclear weapons, first of all, was, you know, the mutual, you know, possession and the fear of a mutually assured destruction is what kept the peace during the Cold War? And how much confidence do you have that in other scenarios, India and Pakistan come to mind, it actually makes those two countries less likely to go to war because they have nuclear weapons, even though it's a risky, you know, we always like to call that the risky game of chicken?
That's a very important question, Doug. You know, I do think that during the Cold War, the nuclear, respective nuclear arsenals had a deterrent value vis-a-vis both competitors in the Cold War. But but the risk is has always been there, and more as time progresses, the risk increases. The risk of accidental nuclear war is, I would agree with the experts, is as high or higher than it's ever been, because there's so many technical systems that are applied to nuclear weapons and command and control these days that could go awry. I won't list them, but Ira said you're quite correct. We've been up close a number of times. In a sense, we've given the world a false model of the effectiveness of deterrent in the Cold War, and that those new nuclear weapons states can claim the deterrent value of nuclear weapons with respect to their own dyad, which is the case perhaps in India and Pakistan. So I'm concerned that the people have maybe wrongly come to the conclusion that we have a comfort zone by mutual deterrence with nuclear weapons. The risk, in my opinion, is still very high. And once we cross the nuclear threshold, I have not a lot of faith that the players or the combatants will exercise the discipline to bring such a conflict to an early conclusion. They talk about it. I mean, the philosophers talk about escalation dominance and somehow preventing the nuclear war from getting out of control. But I personally don't have that kind of confidence that political pressure on the policymakers to escalate to a point where the other side waves the white flag. It runs pretty deep, and I'm just not sure the timing of a nuclear war will allow that kind of step-by-step process to lead to some sort of logical conclusion. I think all bets are off. Once a nuclear war starts, I'm just not confident that anybody will have the political chutzpah to call a halt to it. My personal cynicism, I'm sorry, but that's kind of the way I see it.
Well, I would totally agree with that assessment, Wayne. I think that once we cross the nuclear threshold, the chance of avoiding a very large-scale nuclear war is very small. But I think it's also important, as you suggested, to appreciate how flawed deterrence has been. It may have had something of an inhibitory effect on the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But as Robert McNamara famously said, the reason we didn't have a nuclear war was simply because we were very lucky. We lucked out repeatedly. On numerous occasions, either Moscow or Washington actually made a decision to launch its nuclear arsenal, always in the mistaken belief that it was under attack by the other side. And on each of those occasions, we essentially, both sides, abandoned deterrence and said, we're going to fight a nuclear war. We put bombers in the air, we took the caps off of our missile silos, and we began the process of launching nuclear war. And it wasn't a wise doctrine. It wasn't great game theory that saved us. It was luck. And we have to understand that. Our current policy of maintaining thousands of nuclear warheads in a ready state, many of them on hair trigger alert, is nothing more than a hope for continued good luck. And that's a pretty bad basis for national security policy.
This is Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking today about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons with Ira Helfand of the Physicians for Social Responsibility and Wayne Glass, Professor Emeritus from the University of Southern California. On the sort of normative position, and this is particularly salient here in the United States, there have been at least two instances since the end of the Cold War where there's been significant consideration seemingly given to the so-called low-yield nuclear weapons. One was whether or not the U.S. might use a low-yield nuclear weapon as a form of a bunker buster during the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq in fighting the global war on terror. And I know during the initial conversations about military engagement with North Korea, some of the conversations about the so-called bloody nose scenario where the U.S. might strike North Korea quickly to force them to try to give up their nuclear weapons, some of the conversations were about the potential use of a low-yield nuclear weapon even against the North Koreans. How much is this treaty directed towards those sorts of questions to try to prohibit even the consideration of the use of nuclear weapons as an interim step towards prohibition? And again, I have the sort of chemical weapons in mind where we prohibited their use first and then began, working towards eliminating stockpiles. Ira Helfand, I'll direct that to you first.
Thanks, Doug. I think that's exactly how the treaty is meant to operate in the short term. It is part of an effort to stigmatize and then prohibit and then eliminate the weapons. There is an issue on the table today in which nuclear weapons are also being considered, and that is the situation in Iran. And I think it is not at all clear that the United States has ruled out the use of nuclear weapons if we get into a fighting war with Iran, as seems to be a very real danger at this moment in time. The treaty is designed to mobilize world opinion, to help people appreciate the imminence and enormity of the danger posed by these weapons, and by stigmatizing them, make their use more difficult. And it is one of many things that need to be done right now to cool down the situation between the United States and Iran and make certain that this does not escalate into a nuclear war.
Now, Wayne, I know you've done quite a bit of work with folks over in the Pentagon, the Department of Defense. How much is the potential use of nuclear weapons, low-yield nuclear weapons, tactical battlefield nukes, et cetera, how much of that is, was a part of the conversation, at least certainly, while you were there?
This is a really important point, Doug. I'm glad you're focusing on this because I think there's a lot of self-delusion going on in defense circles about low-yield nuclear weapons with a particular tactical use of some sort, as if the use of a low-yield nuclear weapon was somehow more acceptable than a big one on top of an ICBM. As I see it, if the United States were to choose to use a low-yield nuclear weapon in a tactical situation, can you imagine just for a moment how the media would cover that once the news was out? Would they make a distinction between a low-yield nuclear weapon and a nuclear weapon? I don't think so. And once the media plays that card, the politicians of whoever's involved will have to act as if it's a nuclear weapon, whether it's low-yield or not. I just don't see that sort of disciplined logic, the way I look at the way the media acts today, that will govern more sensible distinctions or nuanced distinctions in the case of whether a low-yield nuclear weapon is used. I think it's delusional, and I think, therefore, that a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons without defining whether they are 50 kilotons or a half a kiloton is important. Those distinctions should be irrelevant. A nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon. And once you cross the nuclear line, I think other factors come into play as to what happens next. And it's not a pretty picture. That's my feeling. Now, it's important to note the nuclear posture review of this administration has sought to reduce the distinction between nuclear and conventional weapons, thinking somehow that by reducing that distinction that low-yield nuclear weapons would somehow become more acceptable. Again, I disagree. And I think that once that nuclear threshold is crossed, whether it's low-yield or high-yield, it doesn't matter. It's crossing the Rubicon that we're not exactly sure what will happen, what will follow. It's a risk, as Ira suggested, that brings at risk civilization itself. If we're unable to stop the escalation that would follow a nuclear explosion of any sort.
Absolutely. Now, Ira, you have been doing quite a bit of, you know, of work internationally, you know, reaching beyond the United States. Where do you see the status, in particular in areas like, say, you know, throughout Europe, where none of the NATO members other than the Netherlands participated in the vote for the treaty? Of course, there are a couple of smaller nuclear arsenals in the UK and in France. Is there more of, first of all, just growing recognition of the treaty's existence? I'm struck by how many Americans don't even know the treaty exists, and any growing acceptance that perhaps growing support for the treaty, or are attitudes in other places around the world mirroring that of the United States?
I think there is much more awareness of the treaty, especially in Europe. Also in Japan and Australia, important nuclear umbrella states, and possibly to some degree in South Korea. A number of the countries in NATO are considering signing and ratifying the treaty. None of them are about to do it at the moment, but there is greater pressure in a number of countries, especially in the Netherlands, in Spain, in Iceland, in Norway, and growing in the United Kingdom, for these countries to break with the United States and sign this treaty. And I think as the treaty moves closer towards entry into force, which will probably take place sometime next year when the requisite 50 countries around the world have ratified, I think the pressure will be even greater within the NATO community. We also are seeing here in the United States a burgeoning movement in support of the treaty and in support of the need to abolish nuclear weapons. The Back from the Brink campaign, which was launched about a year and a half ago, has succeeded at this point in securing a unanimous endorsement from the U.S. Conference of Mayors, unanimous endorsement from the Washington, D.C. City Council, the Baltimore City Council, the Los Angeles City Council, overwhelming passage in the California State Legislature, in the Maine State Senate, in the New Jersey Assembly, in the Oregon State Senate, and this campaign is developing across the country. It calls for the United States to embrace the treaty and to enter into negotiations with the other eight nuclear armed states for a verifiable, enforceable agreement to eliminate their arsenals. And it is bringing the issue to the attention of large numbers of people. Clearly not enough. This campaign needs to grow, but it is off to a very, very strong start in the last year and a half.
Wayne Glass, this conversation seems to be particularly salient considering the current administration's position that seems to, at one level, questioning exactly how far the nuclear umbrella might extend. And by nuclear umbrella, meaning that if a country were attacked, if a U.S. ally were attacked, the U.S. would commit to defending that country, even possibly with nuclear weapons. And the administration seems to have raised questions about how far that might extend throughout NATO, which could, you know, potentially compel other NATO countries to perhaps consider, you know, developing a small nuclear arsenal, and in particular the two countries that seem to be cited quite a bit, in particular because of North Korea, are Japan and South Korea. What kind of effect do you see this treaty, you know, being signed and open for signature and ratification after the 2016 election, although the planning for this, you know, certainly took place well before the 2016 election, but the salience of this treaty after the 2016 election and some current trends in U.S. foreign policy?
Here's a scenario, Doug. With the current crisis vis-a-vis Iran and the Gulf and nuclear issues relating to it, there's an opportunity for the American public to become more aware of the danger of a nuclear exchange in that part of the world. Or the use of the U.S. or Western nuclear weapons in that part of the world, it's possible that escalation scenario could occur. So that said, if the American people are paying attention to this crisis, it should become, might well become, a major issue in the political campaign for 2020. And if the presidential candidates begin talking about this issue and the treaty in the same breath, I think there's an opportunity for the American public to become engaged in a way that they haven't been engaged in quite a long time. Maybe that's, in some sense, wishful thinking. But as it stands now, I don't see the administration or the Pentagon or the Department of Energy is shifting their attitude towards the nuclear stockpile and its improvements and expansions and all those sorts of things, the treaty notwithstanding. Our decision makers are truly looking the other way. And until the American voters and politicians in a campaign raise the issue and put it to the front burner, I think the current administration is going to continue to ignore it.
It's exactly right. You know, at the moment, there are essentially two existential threats that face humanity: catastrophic climate change and nuclear war. And they really need to be the central issues that are debated in the 2020 election campaign. There are lots of other incredibly important issues, and I do not mean to diminish the significance of the other issues that people are looking to. But none of those things are going to matter if we destroy the planet through climate change or blow it up with a nuclear war. And these are real imminent threats. So in 2016, neither one of these issues got any play in the election campaign. It seems clear that this time around, climate change will be a major issue. And the challenge, I think, is to make sure that the prevention of nuclear war also becomes a major focus of conversation during this campaign.
One more comment, Doug, and that's, you sort of implied it in your question, the administration's attitude towards defending a NATO ally. I don't believe when the administration came into office in 2016 that they truly understand what NATO was all about, and they were kind of fast and loose with American obligations under the terms of the NATO treaty. That's changed. I think the administration and the White House has got the picture now that that NATO is a key element of our overall national security strategy. So the question of whether or not the United States would respond to a Russian attack on Latvia or Estonia, both members of NATO at this point. In times past, there might have been a discussion in the White House about that, but I think that time has passed. And I think this administration has come to recognize that our obligations under the NATO treaty are real and they're not to be played with. So should that kind of a situation scenario arise, I don't think there'll be much of a debate within the Trump administration about whether or not the U.S. is going to respond. I think they will.
This is Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking today about the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons with Ira Helfand of the Physicians for Social Responsibility and Wayne Glass, Professor Emeritus from the University of Southern California. Now, there's two non-American developments that I think are particularly salient. I want to make sure that we discuss. The first is the U.S. is not the only country that is advocating potentially increasing their stockpile, modernization, etc. There's been quite a bit of language assertions, some suggestions of policies coming out of Moscow that the Russians are just as potentially eager to modernize, even potentially, there's been some conversation, they might want to set the CTBT aside. As much as the U.S. would oppose this treaty, I imagine Moscow would oppose it at least as much, if not more. And then the other is the developments where the Chinese government seems to be interested in increasing the size of their stockpile, which at this point is relatively small, particularly in comparison to the U.S. and Russia. There's an obvious desire to focus on the U.S. government because we're in the United States. But how much, you know, should the focus be on those two countries in particular and their contributions towards undermining the movement that we've been able, you know, to make, the successes we've been able to make to decrease nuclear stockpiles? Ira?
I think we need to focus on the U.S. government because I think in the current situation, it's the U.S. government that is going to play a lead in getting rid of these weapons if anyone does. You know, back in the 80s, it wasn't the U.S. It was the Soviet Union. It was Gorbachev in particular who understood the need to get rid of these weapons and really provided the impetus for the developments that we saw then that led to the end of the Cold War arms race. I don't see a Gorbachev in Russia today, and I don't see one in China either. I don't see one in the current administration here in the United States, but perhaps among the 20 candidates who are running to replace Mr. Trump in the next election, there will be somebody who will have the vision and the understanding and the courage to play the role that Gorbachev played during the Cold War. And so I think the U.S. really is the place that we need to be focusing on the most. This does not mean to diminish your concerns about what's going on in Russia and in China, both of which are also acting as though they do not understand what's going to happen if nuclear weapons are used, which is the dilemma that we've encountered over and over again. The people who are in charge of these weapons literally do not seem to understand what's going to happen if the bombs go off. I would add, in addition to Russia and China, I think we also need to be very, very concerned about what's happening in South Asia, where there is an active arms race. India and Pakistan are adding nuclear weapons as it is. They are building up their arsenals. And the chance of that situation getting out of control is very great. We can't, here in the United States, directly affect that. But the only way that situation is going to be brought under control, I think, is if the major nuclear powers make it clear that they are going to work for the abolition of all nuclear weapons, including the weapons held by the smaller nuclear armed states.
Wayne Glass, the same question, but raising South Asia, that was a concern of mine as well. I know recently there has been some conventional military exchanges between India and Pakistan over the ever-persistent sore point of Kashmir, and after at least about a decade of conversation that the possession of nuclear weapons kind of calmed down potential conventional warfare, that seems to have eroded, and the two countries seem to at least be willing to risk an escalation to nuclear war with the use of conventional weapons and asymmetrical weapons like the use of terrorism. So I guess my question is, at this point, how concerned should we be about South Asia as this hotspot with an arms race, which includes a nuclear arms race?
For a number of years, I would return to Washington, D.C. with students from the University of Southern California for period each summer, and I would travel around the city and meet with my colleagues who are very much involved with nuclear weapons issues. And the common denominator in those conversations every summer was what was their ultimate nightmare, and consensus was about South Asia, India, Pakistan. Either by intent or by accident, the possibility of a nuclear exchange in South Asia was higher than maybe anywhere else. And that was a consensus. That wasn't just one or two people. That was a number of people inside and outside the administration who share that angst. I still do. I think it's a great concern and something that we, the United States, need to pay a close attention to, work however we can to improve the sense of nuclear security between those two potential combatants in South Asia. And I know we have a number of programs over the years that work to try to put that on a more stable footing. to prevent accidental nuclear exchange in South Asia. But I want to get back to the other point, which I think is really important. We seem to be locked in with the Putin leadership in Moscow and Trump leadership in Washington. We seem to be locked into this death spiral that we're in the middle of. I'm remembering quite well the advent of Gorbachev and the breaking of the ice with Reagan in the 1980s. It was a polar change back in those days. So part of me, still being the dreamer, hopes that leadership changes, both in Moscow and the Washington, might provide an opportunity for new leadership in both capitals to begin a conversation that's politically acceptable. And until that happens, it's really hard for both Putin and Trump to escape from the policy positions that they have espoused, and they are now, I think, in effect, captured by. So I'm looking for a sea change, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that in both capitals we'll have a change of leadership that will afford us an opportunity for genuine conversation, just as was the case when Gorbachev took over in Moscow in the 1980s and had those very positive conversations with Reagan and then George H.W. Bush. So I think there's a chance, but I think one of the elements to moving forward here is a change in leadership in both countries.
Observation on my part is that we tend to focus on the leaders themselves, but I know particularly in the United States, there was quite a bit of pressure on the Reagan administration to do something about the escalating nuclear arms race and the advent, particularly in the 1970s, of a really vibrant nuclear freeze movement that the administration was trying to undercut through negotiations. So I have a confidence that the popular pressure, both from below, from within societies, as well as international pressures, can play a role. So I'm setting this up for you, Ira, to talk about what's the best ways for people concerned with the presence of nuclear weapons and supportive of the norms, the principles, and the treaty itself, the treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons. What's the best way to try to exercise some of that influence, to try to change the conversation and to put this on the international and on the national agenda so we might start to see some changes?
I share your analysis. I think that it's very important that there be enormous public pressure on our leaders. Gorbachev's decisions to change his thinking actually came in response to some significant pressure within the Soviet Union. Reagan's decisions to meet Gorbachev to change his thinking, which was an incredibly profound sea change in the way he looked at nuclear weapons, his decision to make that change was partially mediated by conversation, by being educated about what nuclear weapons were going to do, and it was partly a response to the public pressure that was growing in this country. I think we need to operate on both tracks. We need to try to get to the decision makers, and not just the top leaders, but all the people around them who helped formulate nuclear policy, and help them understand more clearly than they do the danger that they are leading us all into. And I think it's terribly important that we build a real movement in this country that will put pressure on our leaders to do the right things. The Back from the Brink campaign is modeled very directly on the Freeze campaign of the 80s. Same idea that we would make a simple statement of what U.S. nuclear policy ought to be and try to get people around the country, governments, religious groups, civic groups, professional associations, labor unions, to endorse that new policy and try to create effectively a national consensus on what the new nuclear policy should be. You know, people who are wanting to do something about this, I would urge to join this campaign. The best way is to go to the website preventnuclearwar.org and learn how people can become involved in this effort to mobilize around the country for a fundamental change in U.S. nuclear policy.
And Wayne Glass, I know you have a lot of experience on the Hill, and so sometimes the focus might be on the presidency and the administration, but what kinds of advice might you have for an activist on this issue that if they want to try to influence, you know, policymaking from the legislative perspective?
Doug, you're reading my mind, exactly. You know, I talked about the need for a change in leadership, but leaders have changed over time, and we've had a series of leaders, new leaders, at least in the United States in recent years, and that hasn't obviated the interest groups that continue to push the nuclear weapons business in the United States. That includes our nuclear laboratories, whose business it is to design and test nuclear weapons. They love that work. They're dedicated to it. They've done it forever. Their payrolls are huge as a result of that. So they are huge interest groups in states of New Mexico and Nevada and California and other states, South Carolina, Tennessee, around the country, who work very hard with their legislators to make sure that the money continues to flow from nuclear weapons programs and related programs. The whole modernization of the nuclear infrastructure is incredibly costly, and it has deep political roots in Congress every year when the authorization and appropriation bills come around. So I agree that public interest groups, that people who feel strongly about it should look to public interest groups, but don't overlook the possibility and in fact, the obligation to communicate with your and participate in elections to make sure that these issues are in the public eye during an election season. They are on the party platforms in the state elections and federal elections. These things need to get in the public eye through the electoral process, in my opinion. And it's really important for people who have political clout, and even average citizens, to push their elected representatives in the House and the Senate to oppose some ill-advised steps to expand and advance America's nuclear weapons program and their sort of extremist national security agenda with respect to a nuclear posture. So we, the citizens, can't look the other way. We need to get involved, either in public interest groups, but certainly with respect to communicating with your Congress. And you can do that by best, in my opinion, the best thing to do is to write a letter to the legislative assistant in charge of national security and foreign policy in whatever office you're dealing with, and get their attention and have a dialogue with those advisors. Yes, the members are the ones who count, but it's the advisors are the ones who get the message to the particular elected representatives that this stuff matters to the people who vote. That's the way I see it.
And the good news is you can find that information usually online. And of course, one last thing is we're going to be in the middle of a very substantial, quite politically engaged campaign. And one of the increasingly important norms are the candidates want to reach out. They have these town halls. They have these conversations. We have the opportunity to ask questions. And I think the first thing we all need to do is to start asking of representatives those questions. One of the reasons why I wanted this conversation is for the listeners to know of the treaty. I'm struck by how many people still don't know this treaty exists. Find out more about it. The question I always like to ask arms control specialist policymakers is how much are we working towards a zero option? And I think that this treaty is the legal instrument towards working towards that option. Thank you very much, Ira Halfin. Thank you very much, Wayne Glass, for this conversation.
Thank you, Doug. And Ira, it's been a pleasure.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Doug, for organizing this discussion.
Thanks.
Ira Halfin is co-chair of the Physicians for Social Responsibility's Nuclear Abolition Committee and serves on the International Coalition Against Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN's steering committee. He is co-author of Nuclear Family, 2 Billion at Risk. Professor Wayne Glass is an emeritus professor in the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California and also the former senior policy advisor to Senator Jeff Bingaman on the Senate Armed Services Committee.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.